And that's how crazy the human body and mind is, and tricking yourself. And that's kind of an interesting point, is like, if I can race on a broken hip, man, I can put up with a lot of pain, and I can get through a lot. And it's kind of, now I look at it and go, wow, like, man, if I can run with a broken leg, like, you know, what's my heartbeat a few heartbeat higher? Like, it's nothing in the grand scheme of things.
Welcome to the Evolution of Leaders podcast. My name is Darwin Lee, and I am a coach and speaker. I'm the founder of the Evolution of Leaders. On this podcast, I'm interested in exploring the traits, habits, or behaviors that set apart elite performers through their stories and in their own words. On this episode, I interview Tyler Mislawchuk, world-class triathlete at the Rio Olympics in 2016, was the youngest competitor, won the 2019 Tokyo International Test event before the Tokyo Olympics, and of course those were postponed, but then leading into the Tokyo Olympics in 2021, just winning the World Cup race in Huatulco, hopefully pronounced that right, has been ranked as high as fifth in the ITU world rankings. Tyler's amazing self-belief, racing alongside legends of the sport. He sees them as people, as other competitors, not intimidated from the beginning, racing to win even alongside the legends. And he sets his goals so big, it causes him doubt. And amazingly, in Rio, finishing 15th as the youngest competitor, finished 15th with a fractured leg. Just an amazing story of perseverance, just sheer mental toughness. I hope you enjoy this interview.
I'm Tyler Mislawchuk, like you said, Olympic triathlete, Canadian. I grew up playing pretty much any sport you can think of: football, hockey, soccer, baseball, pretty much anything, and kind of fell into triathlon when I was 14. Did one, was way too hard, said I'm never doing that again, and 2 years later I picked it up, and as they say, the rest is history. I started training at kind of 16 as a full-time athlete, and went from there, trained in Manitoba, Manitoba boy, prairie boy, and trained 2 years here in university before kind of putting it on hold to try to qualify for the games. And now we're training for Tokyo 2021.
And so one of the interesting things about you is that, you know, you didn't like triathlon at first, and then you basically wanted to compete in the Manitoba Games, Manitoba province in Canada. And so you're basically looking for a sport to compete in more competitively. And so that's what led you into triathlon, which is amazing, given that you first didn't like it.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say that I hated it. I was young, and there was more fun things to do. Team sports, I loved being part of a team. That was something I really loved. And triathlon was just hard. I mean, it was fun, but it was hard. And as a young kid, I guess I just kind of wanted to avoid it. And yeah, fell into it because I wanted to go to Manitoba Games. It was too late in the year to do any other sports. So I figured, well, I'll give triathlon a try. And I managed to qualify for the team, so I was pretty fortunate there.
And good for you. And so, I mean, you really climb the ranks pretty quickly, and you find yourself, you know, the Olympics in Rio 2016, and congratulations on that, by the way. And you're the youngest competitor at 21 and at 22. And somewhere in that time period during the Olympics, I understand you had your birthday, and you end up on the start line. Did you ever think you'd be in that position?
Like, when I started triathlon, like you said, for Manitoba Games, I didn't have like a dream of going to Olympics. Obviously, I loved watching Olympics growing up. You know, it was a favorite time of year when you could just stream the Olympics and cheer on Canadians for sports that you didn't even usually follow. I just got so into it. But when I started, it was just for Manitoba Games. And I kind of had the mentality that I always had very short-term vision, which is a strength and a weakness, I think. So when I wanted to go to Manitoba Games, it wasn't like, oh, I'd love to go to the Olympics one day. It was more like, no, I want to go to Manitoba Games. And then after that, I set a new goal, and it was something maybe smaller, but it was kind of every step of the way. I remember finishing the Olympics, and that was probably the surreal moment that, you know, people would talk about, is I kind of crossed the line, was like, holy cow, like, I, you know, that just happened. That was something that I watched on TV growing up.
Wow. And so today, from that time, you finished 15th, and today you're ranked 5th in the world. You win the Olympic test event in Tokyo, which is a big deal because it's very competitive and everyone wants to get a feel for the course before the actual Olympics. So what's the biggest change you made from finishing, you know, 15th in 2016 to what you've achieved to date and your improvement?
I mean, there's a lot of changes. I'm an older athlete, so obviously I'm more mature. I'm with a different coach now. I'm with John O'Hall. There's a multitude of things. And, you know, for performance to line up, it's not just physical shape. There's a lot of things that have to line up for you to be best on your race day. I was actually talking about it with someone else, and there's a curve of being fit and there's a curve of learning how to race. And I think I'm coming into those years now that I am both fit and have, you know, played the game and learned how to race and how to train properly and be consistent in that way. I don't think any success story you hear is just a flash in the pan. A lot of it is, well, there was a lot of consistency that led into the success, which is kind of what I'm, you know, seeing now.
So what's a change you've made in terms of your mental approach or your attitude?
One of the things that I have started doing is treating every race like an opportunity that I may never have again. I think I found myself in the earlier years racing and just being happy to be there and, you know, being content with, you know, this is a great result already. And now, you know, when I get into a race and it could be a great result, but I don't ever settle. I treat it as, you know, a sport and life, it's pretty unpredictable in the sense that, you know, it can, you know, sport can be over at any time and I'm aware that it can be ended. So I don't take that for granted and kind of, you know, race like it could be the last one.
And so when you're racing with that kind of mentality now compared to, you know, 2, 3, 4 years ago, is that actually going through your mind or is it in preparation or both, or kind of how does that enter into converting that into performance?
I mean, yeah, in the race, a good example would be, you know, I'm racing and I come to a moment in the run when it's really starting to hurt and, you know, and maybe in past, let's say I'm in third place, I'm like, oh, you know, third place, that's pretty good. Like I that was my goal. I was wanting to be third place. Versus now, you know, in that same moment, I would click myself out of it and go, like, when are you going to get a chance to win a race like this again, rather than going, oh, I'm happy for third. And that doesn't mean that I still don't have lapses in that. I'm human. And sometimes I've caught myself after. You don't realize in the moment, but where your mind, you're hurting so much, your mind convinces you, no, this is good enough.
The interesting thing about you is kind of at a young age, as you've progressed and improved and it's shown in your results, do you have a habit or behavior that you think might separate you as, you know, elite amongst elites, that might separate you from those that are not quite there?
It's a tough question because I don't know the psychology of every athlete I'm racing. And so thus it's hard for me to separate. All I know is about myself. So for me, I'm relentless in the fact that whenever I choose to walk away from sport, I think I'll be able to say that, okay, yes, I was happy in my career, but currently I'm never satisfied. And a lot of athletes talk about it. It's just a hunger that, you know, winning the Olympic test event was like a dream come true. But I remember the next day thinking, you know, it's not worth anything unless I win the Olympics, or anything unless I go and have a good result at the Olympics. I think most athletes would have just been like, oh, that, you know, Olympic test event, that's already more than I planned. And for me, it's always a blessing and a curse in the terms of that. I have a hard time celebrating a result because I know that for me, you're only as good as your last race. And I'm constantly having to prove myself, not only in racing, but in training. And so maybe it's a mentality that, you know, I'm never satisfied.
Is this a conscious thing or is it something that's innate in you? If it's conscious, I wonder what that process might look like.
To be honest, I couldn't tell you, but I know from from whenever I started any sport, it was maybe not a problem, but it was something that was part of me. Whether I was playing baseball, soccer, hockey, it was never that's good enough attitude, which I talked about. It was never like, oh, that's good enough. And it was always like, well, what can I do better? I'm very analytical thinker in terms of like analyzing situations and trying to learn, you know, what I can do better. And I don't think that I ever turn it off. You know, I could go and win the Olympics next year and I would find a way to not enjoy it to the fullest probably because I'm wanting to do something else. Which, I mean, sometimes you have to stop and smell the roses, as they say. And that's something I've actually been trying to work on because I think it is great to set goals and, you know, reevaluate right away like I do, which is what makes me a good athlete. But if you don't ever, you know, enjoy the moments, then I think it's harder to continue for year after year and be consistent if you're never, you know, getting those highs.
In some of your earliest World Cups, you finished near the back of the pack. And so you're saying you have been relentless and you're analytical in how you evaluate, you know, maybe how you raced or what's the next step. Coming out of those, when you're finishing near last, what did you learn from those things and implement as far as change?
I think for, like you talked about these World Cups, I really struggled at the start of my career. And I don't think it was necessarily, it was a mix of physical preparation and mental preparation, but I knew the results were not what I was physically capable of. So I took a step back and went, well, like if I'm training at this level and I'm getting these results, it doesn't really add up. So what can I change? And one of the biggest things was, which I kind of do unconsciously now, is visualize the race and take proper rest before races, which are two big things. Again, my personality is that I always want to push, I always want to do more, I always want to do better, and kind of telling myself, putting the reins on myself a bit. And the coaches that I have worked with kind of know this now, is that I almost need to be reined in a bit for myself mentally and physically before race, and not to leave, you know, races and training sessions, which sometimes I was doing, which is not only a physical thing, but a mental thing. When you dig that deep, you can only do it, for me, you can only do it so many times in a year.
Wow. Okay. So, you know, and going back and tracing through, you've also had to fight through a fair amount of adversity. So I'm going to go through a list here, and this is not to say triathlon's a dangerous sport, but it's quite a list. Your first World Cup, you broke three ribs, you injured your quad. Your second World Cup, you break your jaw. At the 2016 Rio Olympics, you have some tightness in your leg. Turns out it's a stress fracture in your femur, the thigh bone. You still finish 15th. In Edmonton, you have a stomach stitch. You finish 9th, top 10. Montreal, you win the bronze, and you're quoted as saying, "My legs came off a bit and they popped me off around one of the final corners." And right now you're working in what you call your pain cave. So you say we all have adversity in our lives. I'm just putting my head down and moving forward. What does that look like, to put your head down and move forward?
Yeah. I mean, you nailed it when you talked about it. I think you only missed one, and I was Pan Am Games in 2015. I broke three ribs before the race and didn't know they were broken. It was kind of just sore and I had a bit of trouble breathing, and it turned out after I had three dislocated and fractured ribs as well. So yeah, triathlon, I mean, there's always risk in any sport, but I think one of the things that was interesting was when I broke my jaw, I had four bolts in it and I had my mouth wired shut. So I was on liquid diet and I was forced to come home. I spent 8 days in the hospital, and my parents told me after, they really thought that was going to be the nail in the coffin for me, because it was my second World Cup and I had trained maybe 5 months straight for this race, and it was looking to be my big breakthrough, and something like this happened that was completely out of my control. And I remember coming home, and as soon as I got home, it was like, well, what can I do? There was just no hesitation of feeling bad for myself. And I think that's what a lot of people get caught in, is just feeling bad for yourself. And yeah, there's points in my life that I felt bad for myself, and you know, that's going to happen no matter what, but I create a plan as soon as something happens, how to overcome it. So for example, then it was like, okay, I can't swim because I can't breathe in the water. I can't run because of the movement, but I can be on the bike, on a stationary bike because there's no risk. And maybe I can be on an anti-gravity treadmill because there's no bouncing in my jaw. And it was just like I talked about earlier, it's just like a complete focus in what I was doing in terms of, well, I'm going to go on the treadmill today. I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that. And I don't know when I'm going to return, but I'm going to do that. And tomorrow I'll do this. And the next day I'll do that. And before you know it, you know, you're back racing a few months later. But it was interesting that my parents said after the fact that, you know, they thought that was it for me. Not because they didn't believe in me, just because it's hard when it's easier when you've done it to yourself or screwed up, but when it's out of your control, like a lot of these crashes and races are, you know, I think it's a bit harder to deal with because again, you fall into the feel bad for yourself mentality.
Did your parents share those sentiments with you at the time?
No, definitely not. I think sharing those would have discouraged me. It was kind of after the fact and, you know, years later saying, you know, we thought that was going to be the, you know, what was going to crack you because they knew I was mentally tough. But I mean, at a certain point, everyone, you know, has a cracking point or a boiling point, and they thought that was going to be it for me. So I think they, you know, they when they saw that, they said, you know, that, you know, they believed that I could not overcome anything, because that kind of sounds corny, but was that, you know, it's going to take a lot to go wrong for Tyler to leave the sport.
Okay. So as far as overcoming adversity, I want to get to, there's something I just can't get over, which is that you're the youngest person in the field at the Rio Olympic Games. You finish 15th, which is really, really a good result. You run a 32:33 in the run on a stress fracture in your femur. And so in the moment, what do you do to make it through that pain and that discomfort?
Yeah. So my leg kind of got a bit sore, like I'd say 3 or 4 weeks before the games. And everyone was in the loop in terms of knowing, you know, what it was. And yeah, everyone, and we all thought it was, you know, maybe a pulled muscle or sore or something. And it was like, okay, well, you can get through the race and you still like probably can have a good result, and then we'll deal with it after. And so the next day I got an x-ray, and yeah, I stress fracture in my femoral neck. But in terms of the actual racing, I think that was probably the easiest part of those 4 weeks. Obviously the training was not easy. It was quite painful the last few weeks going into the games. But I think that I'm such a racer that, you know, when I got into the race was easier than actually warming up for the race. I remember doing one beach start because it was a beach start on the swim. And I would usually do a few, and I did one because my leg was so sore I couldn't run into the water. And me thinking like, oh man, I can't barely run into the water. But then I go and run, you know, I swim 1500, bike 40K and run 10K on pavement. Again, it's hurting the entire time. But I think as triathletes, we're, you know, pain tolerance is obviously high, but what we do in training is we build up our pain tolerance as well, mental and physical. And I think that I had done so much training on it that I knew that it was going to hurt. And again, like it goes back to the maybe not focusing on the day-to-day like I was talking about, but literally one step in front of the other. And it was one step in front of the other, one step in front of the other. And just make it to the finish line. Again, and I got so competitive within the race. I feel like in the last probably few K, I didn't even feel my leg. And then I remember stopping, sitting down right after the race, and I went to stand up, and I couldn't really stand up. And that's how crazy the human body and mind is, and tricking yourself. And that's kind of an interesting point. Is like if I can race on a broken hip, man, I can put up with a lot of pain, and I can get through a lot. And it's kind of, now I look at it and go, wow, like, man, if I can run with a broken leg, like, you know, what's my heartbeat a few heartbeat higher? Like, it's really, it's nothing in the grand scheme of things.
Wow. So in the moment, your strategy is, I'm just going to put one foot forward at a time, one step at a time. But now you're looking back at that and using it, you know, as further confidence, it seems like.
Yeah, I think as an athlete, you take whatever you've done in the past, any successes, and you try to find confidence in it. And that's what kind of, you know, builds you up. It's the same way sports teams, when they get on a roll or they start playing well, sometimes even when you're missing some of your best players on that team, they continue to have success because of the confidence instilled in them. And that's the same way I would say now is, you know, I could be at 95% of the fitness I was at in 2016 and probably still get the same result in terms of I just have this confidence and knowledge in racing that I just didn't have as a youngster that you can, you know, rely on. Humans use mental, you know, experiences from the past to shape their future. And that's kind of what racing is. The more you race, the more experiences you have, the more you have in your notebook that you use for future races.
And so what was your mental strategy? Sometimes in sports psychology, they talk about a mantra. I don't know if you use that, but when you have a stomach stitch, and for those who don't know, it's kind of like a stabbing, intense stabbing pain just under the rib cage when you're during physical activity. And so how are you getting that? Is it just same thing, just one step in front of the other? How are you denying pain or working through the pain?
What I've kind of done is, you know, whatever I have, it was creating systems to deal with things. So, I mean, dealing with a stitch, there's a few things. It's one step in front of the other, but it's also if you can, you know, get rid of something like a side stitch as possibly you can get rid of, what's the strategy to get rid of it versus, you know, a broken leg? You can't get rid of a broken leg in a race. So that is just complete, you know, focusing on what you're doing versus if it's fixable, then I'll have a strategy to think about it. And I won't just be one foot in front of the other. It'll be, how can I get rid of this? How quickly can I get rid of this and get back to, you know, normal running? So it's depending on what you're dealing with is the different mental strategies and sports psych that goes into what you're doing, I think.
Okay, so you're relying on kind of in the preparation before, you're relying on these systems that you've created to get you through those moments.
Yeah, and those systems are created within training, right? Like, for example, this year, I was before Abu Dhabi was canceled, I was doing a run session, and the run session was really hard. It was probably one of my fastest sessions of the year, and it was kind of in prep for the race. In that session, I was creating systems of, man, this really hurts. This is probably what I'm going to feel in Abu Dhabi. How am I dealing with it now? Remembering the discomfort and going, okay, I've created this system for when I do get on the run in Abu Dhabi. You know, how am I going to deal with it? What am I going to do? What are, you know, cue points?
Moving forward to the 2019 Olympic test event, which you won, which is, that had to be a big confidence booster. You said to yourself, yeah, I may never have the chance to win a big race again, so I've got to take it now. Now, one of the things that sometimes comes up in psychology, sports psychology, is the concept that we focus on the process before the outcome. So we're not worried about winning the medal. We're worried about, as you've said, the systems, the process of getting there, of running, of putting one step before the other. And yet here, you're saying you may not have a chance to win a big race, so I've got to take it now. So you're focused on the outcome. So what does that balance look like of process versus outcome?
Yeah, I think that you need a mix of both process and outcome. I think that people make the mistake of only having process goals or only having outcome goals. And I've been there where I've had people in the past say, you know, you just need process goals or, oh, like what place do you want to get? And for me, it's having the combination of both of them. And balancing is a hard act. You know, when I go into a race, I obviously have process goals and I have an outcome goal. But I think I'm not really thinking about the outcome goal until pretty much all the processes are done. For example, in Tokyo, when I'm swimming, I'm not thinking about winning. When I'm biking, I'm not thinking about winning. And when I get into the run in a position where strategy and, you know, craftiness is a tool, I'm thinking, yeah, how am I going to win? It's not, oh, I want to win. It's how am I going to win? And so it really being process-based until you're in a position where you're really creating strategies on how, you know, you've put yourself in the position to win. Okay, now how am I going to? And so I think it's useless to think, oh, I want to win when you're in the water, because I mean, you're not in a position to win at that point. And so it's useless thinking about that. And you're thinking about your technique and you're thinking about process that you've set up. So yeah, I really don't think about the outcome until I'm actually in a position that it's possible for it to happen.
So, you know, as you're coming through to the end of a race, do you view it, you know, and you're really looking to seize, you know, the win or the podium finish or to pass a competitor, do you view that as a goal, or is that something kind of more in the moment, less kind of more primal almost?
Yeah. I mean, when you're racing, it's completely primal and it's completely, you know, in the moment. But again, hopefully you've created, or I've created, these systems in training that if I do forget or lose track of what I'm doing, that I've done it so many times in training, and these systems, mental systems I've set up, that it becomes something you almost fall back on. You know, that's what creates success, is when you've done something so many times that, you know, you can almost do it without thinking about it. And obviously, yeah, you're thinking about it when you're racing, but it is a very in the moment. And, you know, you can visualize a race 1,000 times. You can do that, you know, 100,000 times, and it still may not be exactly what you visualize. So I think it's being adaptable and being in the moment is key to some of that.
And you talked about visualization there, and I was wondering if you could take us through what that looks like to you. What's most effective for you for visualization?
I like visualizing when I'm actually doing things. And so I've tried visualizing, and I still do, but I have a harder time doing it when I'm, you know, let's say I'm just sitting in bed or sitting on the floor and trying to visualize a race. I can do it, but I don't think it's the best result, yields the best results. I think for me, the best results are done when I'm visualizing, like I said, in a specific training session, or I'm out for a run and I'm able to, you know, picture the finish chute or picture how I'm jumping in the water. And for me, actually doing the similar movements cues my mind to be able to, you know, be more present in what I'm visualizing. For example, I'm visualizing running and I'm running, it's easier for me to put myself in that spot that I want to be, what I want to be doing.
When you visualize, how of the senses, kind of which ones are you?
I would say seeing is obviously one of the biggest for me. Obviously you hear things, but I think the biggest is actually just, you know, vision. It's not anything else, and just what's happening around me. I think when you're racing, there's not many sounds. I mean, there's a lot of sounds around you, but when I'm having a good race, usually I'm in my own mind. I don't hear much. Like, I've been known, like, when a coach yells something, you know, sometimes I don't even hear it because I'm very much, you know, I've got that tunnel vision, as they say, like, where I'm seeing things and I'm hearing things, but I'm not really hearing things. And so for me, visualizing, there's no point of hearing things because, to be honest, I'm in my own head anyways. I'm not listening to anyone else.
How about, that's interesting. Like, for instance, at your, regarding your awareness in Montreal, when you win bronze, there was a pack of seven, and then you dropped Spain's Javier Gomez, who is legendary in the sport. Does that, are you aware of that, or are you focused just on who's around you, or kind of what's the level of awareness as in that moment?
So my awareness, I think, is strictly, you know, put onto things that can help me benefit in the race. So in terms of that, if someone falls off and your strategy was built around beating them, then obviously you have to adjust your strategy. So in terms of, you know, a legend like Javier Gomez falling off, my strategy wasn't adjusted so much because I know going into the race, he's not a sprinter and it's a big group. So this isn't going to really affect how I change my strategy. But again, I only really have awareness to things that will directly affect me. And so I'm not focusing on a pack behind or anything like that in the actual moment. I'm only focusing on things that are going to help me cross the line in first. And so, for example, that one, I would have noticed. Yeah.
Okay, that's interesting. And so I would imagine that's something that you can take forward with confidence as well. Even for me, just to read that sentence, the pack dropped Spain's legendary triathlete, Javier Gomez. I mean, that's like a legendary world champion in triathlon. And you're right there with those that are moving past him. And so what does that do as far as confidence, or how do you look back at that and take lessons?
To be honest, one of the things that I think is being my, you know, how I grew up was that when I'm racing, I don't really think about Javier Gomez, legend of triathlon. I think, you know, it's another guy that I'm racing. I think that's the way I've had to be. I remember in 2015, it was the first chance to qualify for the Olympics, and I had just started racing that year at the highest level, 2015. And it was, if you finish in the top eight, you went to the games. And I said, well, I'm going to try to finish in the top eight. And I ran in, I think, seventh or eighth for 4K out of 10K, and then blew to pieces and finished 21st. And I remember someone talking to me after, I will leave names out, but basically saying, you know, why did you do that? That was kind of silly. Like, you could have finished, you know, 15th if you had paced yourself properly. You know, these guys have been in the sport and they're legends of the sport, and you're young and upcoming and you'll have your time. And I remember saying to him at the time was that, you know, I respect these guys, and but I don't really fear them at all. And if I don't try to race them now and go up against them, I never will. There's never going to be a right time to, you know, challenge someone you look up to. And so I think the biggest mentality I've had since I started racing is, you know, these are just people. And when you're racing, it doesn't matter what someone's resume is. You're racing them, and you're racing them on their day. And it, you know, if you put them up on this pedestal, you're never gonna beat someone in anything, whether it's in, you know, life or sport. So I think that I've done a good job of just humanizing everyone and just being like, well, these are the guys that I'm racing.
Wow. And so do you think of yourself as one of the top in the world? Does that kind of enter into your mind in some way?
No, not at all. I really, when I go into a race, I have no memory of any other race. And like I said, it's a hard way to go. You know, if I have a bad race, for me, it's obviously not the end of the world, but I am not happy. I'm not like, I'm finished first in the test event. A good example would be I DNF'd the world championships 2 weeks after the test event. And it wasn't like, oh, you know, I won the test event, that's okay. I was, you know, not happy with myself for not finishing that race 2 weeks later. Kind of the mentality of, you know, you're only as good as your last race. And going into races, I think if you think about it in terms of, you know, what you've done, I think it really can take an edge off you in terms of performance. And so whenever I race, I don't really think about what I've done in the past. It's more, I'm racing this race and this is all that there is.
Okay. That's very interesting. And so in Montreal and talking about you've mentioned your coach, Jono or Jonathan Hall, you'd mentioned that you couldn't have done this without him, that he's a big supporter. And you said his role was pivotal with that breakthrough. And it seems like Montreal was a pretty big breakthrough bringing that bronze. And so can you talk about sort of the effect of coaching?
Yeah. I mean, Jono, as I call him, has been a big influence in my career. I came to him in 2017 in the fall, so after the games. And he didn't know much about me as a person, obviously knew me for my results. And so we've been together for 3 years. And I actually remember a quote about that Jono told me was in my first year, he saw me training, was like, man, when you get your first win, there's going to be floodgates open. And, you know, it's going to open up so many opportunities because you just need that almost that first win of confidence. And I remember it was a small race in Italy. It was a professional league race in Italy at the end of 2018, one of my last races. And I won the race and it was an okay field. It wasn't anything spectacular, but I remember him saying again, watch what's going to happen now. And the next year, my first World Cup of the year, I ended up winning and having, you know, that was, you know, this last year and having two other wins in the year. And I thought that was interesting that he realized that from, you know, the first month I was training with him that, you know, this was something he picked up and, you know, maybe I didn't even pick up myself.
And so it seemed like he opened a door mentally for you. And what do you think he saw? I don't know if you talked about this with him, but what did he see or what did he perceive that led him to say that?
I don't know exactly what he saw. I know that he's talked about that. I mean, which can hurt me and be great for me is like we've talked about, is my desire to win. And sometimes my desire to win and do well almost is cancels itself out, because I want to do well and want to win so bad that it actually is a negative. And so it's trying, I think he saw that and just how much I wanted it, which is something that a lot of great athletes have, but it's also something, if you don't deal with correctly, that it can really put a bad spiral on results. Like I said, you know, if you have a bad result, you can really, you know, spiral quickly if you are a win at all cost type of athlete, or do everything or have the desire so much. And I think he saw that in a day-to-day training when I first came.
And that is, as I kind of research your career and look at you objectively from various articles that are out there, I think that is one of the most fascinating aspects of your evolution, is balancing what you call your self-belief in yourself and the burning desire, but that the burning desire just might overcome in some way, or rather not overcome, but it might be overbearing. And so you were asked your greatest threat, and you said it was your own head. So what does that look like now that you've seemed to have found a more, you know, a better balance that allows you to perform better?
Yeah, I mean, that, you know, winning mentality and the ever-going drive is what makes me good, but it's also what can, you know, bring me down. And so I think one of the biggest changes is that I would say I've relaxed a bit more in my, I'm turning 26 this year. I'm a lot more relaxed in terms of my approach than I was at 20. And that can be day to day and within racing. But I think in terms of like day to day, I know that, you know, you're not going to win a race in training and you're not going to lose a race. And so maybe not taking such a heavy weight in every workout or every race and realizing, you know, oh, well, this was just this race. It doesn't define me. Or this was just a bad training session. It doesn't define me. I've got a good example of just, I did a 20-minute power test on the bike last week, and it was really not good. I was a bit tired, but that was kind of the plan going in. And I think a 20-year-old Tyler really would have got in his own head and, you know, said, oh, you know, I'm not in good shape on the bike. Why the test went so bad? And a 26-year-old Tyler says, you know, okay, well, analyze, you know, I was a bit tired, you know, this one power test isn't the be all end all. Yeah, obviously I want to do better, but, you know, this isn't going to be the end of the world. And that bit more relaxed approach has really helped me.
Okay. And so it's not relaxing, I guess, on your desire to win, and it's still having a self-belief, but it's kind of more, feels like it's more measured.
Yeah, measured is a perfect way to say it.
Right now, you know, we should have been headed towards the Olympics just around the corner here. And now, you know, as we know, because of the coronavirus, it's been delayed to 2021. So I'd imagine, you know, some kind of reset. So what does a proper readjustment look like now that, you know, kind of a big goal, 4-year goal has turned into, I guess, a 5-year goal?
Yeah, I obviously the training changes and the approach changes a bit. I don't think any athlete in the world has been in this situation before. Well, I know no athlete has been in this exact situation before, because it's the first of our kind. But I think one of the things is readjusting and then just, you know, proceeding. Like I said, creating a plan, sitting down, John and I sat down, and, you know, how are we going to do the best result we can in, you know, 14 months from now? How is that going to play out, and create a plan backwards and be very, you know, precise. And, you know, I think one of the things that a lot of athletes or people make mistakes is that they tend to focus on what everyone else around them is doing. And especially in today's day and age, there's so much social media, so much content out there, that I think a lot of people and athletes get caught up in what others are doing. And that's kind of, I would say, one of my big changes is that I really, you know, I don't really, not that I don't care, but I really don't watch or follow or put, you know, information in my brain about what other athletes are doing. It's just, this is my plan. This is what I'm doing. It may be completely different than everyone else, but this is what we've created. So there's no point of worrying about what everyone else is doing.
So the ability to adjust planning, you know, as far as coaching goes, what are some other positive traits or characteristics of a good coach?
I think a good coach, I mean, there's a few different characteristics. And again, it depends on the type of athlete that the coach is working with. For me, it's a coach that does really listen. A lot of people say that, but it does really listen, especially as I'm getting older now. I think when you're a younger athlete, you know a little bit less about yourself in terms of what kind of athlete you are, how you respond. I think as you get older, I think having an open communication line is really important. I usually know when it's too much for my body, so having an open communication line is probably number one for me, and being able to be flexible in adjustment. And then obviously there's periods when I go, I shouldn't do that. And Jonna goes, yes, you should. And then, we discuss, and if it's something that's going to benefit me, yeah, obviously I'm going to do it. But I think, yeah, open communication lines.
You set a couple goals. The first is to attend an Olympics, which you've done. And the second goal is to medal. And so you set that goal, and you've talked about working back from that point. And so I'm just wondering if you can take us through how that process looks. So you have a goal 4 years kind of into the future. How do you wind back and then, translate that into a series of actions?
Yeah. I remember my friend made a video of me after 2016 Olympics, and I got quoted in the end saying I had two goals in sport. One of them was to go to Olympics, and one of them was to win a medal. And I remember getting so much backlash on that video because people were like, well, that's a bold statement, win an Olympic medal. There was a lot of comments about that. I remember just seeing them and being like, okay, again, it's one of those things where some people use it as fire. And I was kind of just like, that's your opinion. And I don't really use people's negativity as fire. And I don't really use it. I kind of just go, okay, well, I mean, that's your opinion. You're rightful. And I think that most people in 2016, if you were bettors, would bet that I would not win an Olympic medal in 2020. I think there's very few people that if you said, you have good odds, were you going to put money on Tyler to win an Olympic medal, they would have said no chance. And I think there's probably a few people, and one of myself would be that I would have not put money on myself because that's illegal, but really backed myself in terms of, taking a step at a step. So after I went to Olympics in 2016, I had my injury, I had 6 months off, and I thought, how am I going to do this? Because right now it's a long way to the Olympics, and there's a lot of time to improve. But if I don't, do it properly, I'm going to be sitting at the Olympics going, man, I kind of, puttered around for a few years and it was too late. So again, when I set that goal, I believed in myself, but at the same time, there's always doubt in everyone's mind, including myself, with, you think I've set this goal, but, can I really do it? And for me, that's how I know a goal is big, because if I don't have doubt in it, I know it's too small of a goal. And I, one of the things that I've created all my goals in my sport is that, they scare me. They're, they put doubt in you. And I think that's how you know that you're really chasing a big goal.
Wow. To have doubt. Okay. So you're setting them intentionally so big so that you have doubt. And that's when, it's something you want to go after.
Yeah. I think if a goal doesn't scare you, then it's not big enough. And yeah, that's just my opinion of it. And everyone has goals that are different, but I've always set goals pretty big. And a lot of times I've never publicly voiced my goals because I know that people might laugh me out of the street type of thing, because they just sound so outrageous at the time.
So how do you then handle, I'd imagine it's on social media, and I'd imagine, the criticism is from people who aren't elite athletes. How do you handle that criticism? In what way can you turn it into something positive, or maybe not, you just tune it out?
Yeah. Like I said, I don't put too much value into people who don't have a lot of knowledge in the subject, have to say. And so in terms of creating a team around me is more important. If I get a coach and I say, I want to go to the Olympics, and they go, oh, I don't know if we can do that, then they're probably not the right coach for me. The same way as, I have someone who's working with me and I say, I want to win an Olympic medal, and they go, ooh, that's going to be difficult. Well, probably not the right person to work with me. And those are the people that I actually care and listen to the opinions. Obviously, everyone has an opinion and everyone's always going to voice it, especially with social media these days. And I really just don't, you know, you still read it and you take it in, you process it, because that would be silly to say I don't. But it's really, you know, one in one ear and out the other.
Okay. And so you have, you know, and we talked about this a little bit already, but a deep down self-belief in yourself, in spite of the naysayers, and you just have a confidence about you and in yourself. And so what have you done to build that? What does good, real self-belief feel like and look like?
I think that's a tricky question, because I think people have different self-belief, obviously, and have created in different ways. For me, it's the self-belief is by doing. I really believe that, you know, I can't just fabricate some self-belief in my head. It really has to be done through actions. And the old actions speak louder than words. I'm really big on that in terms of, you know, if I set something out and I do it, well, then why is there's not a reason that if I set something out again and I can't do it. And it's almost every time you set out a goal and you tick the box, it's kind of like, you know, you add a level to yourself, and before you know it, you're standing a bit higher and, you know, your shoulders a bit wider. And I think it's just like setting goals, achieving, and it's, you know, it's building that confidence that, you know, you can accomplish things that you set out to do.
Wow. Okay. Have you always been this way? Is there anything you did to build it?
I would not say anything specifically. Again, like I grew up playing all different kinds of sports, and I think my parents were a big role player in that. Not in the sense of, you know, giving me self-confidence, but their philosophy was that if you do anything, you need to do it properly and you need to be fully committed and put your full heart into it. So if I signed up for anything and wanted to quit, that wasn't allowed. If I chose to sign up for something, I had to stick it through and I had to work hard. And, you know, if I wanted to do it, you made me commit. And I think that's something that, you know, I take now, is that when I do something, I commit, I fully buy into it. And I think the commitment is another thing that gives you self-belief. You know, if you're committed to something well and truly, then, you know, you almost convince yourself, well, like if I'm this committed, there's not that many people out there that are doing what I'm doing.
And so when you made the decision to, you know, your first World Cup and those early results, regardless, you know, how they might have turned out, you really were committed early on.
Yeah. And I think it's easy to be committed when things are going well.
Yeah.
It's hard to be committed when things really are not going well. I think that is when, you know, when you lose people to the sport, is those rocky moments, or, you know, those few bad races or games, you know, that's when it's hard to step back and still have that self-belief when things are going awry. But And I would be lying saying that, you know, you don't get shaken and you don't get that, because that's, you know, completely true. But again, the way I gain self-confidence and the way I go about things is just by doing. You know, like when I said I broke my jaw, I would just put myself straight back into it and gone, okay, well, like if I can do this, I can come back and, you know, that will work. It was just, there was no other way about it. It was just, it's going to work.
On the flip side, when there are pretty amazing pictures of you when you're crossing the line and you've had a good achievement, and I'm sure you've looked at them. Do you take, how do you celebrate, and how do you look back and not just take lessons, but just enjoy the moment? What's that look like?
It's always, there's no ever, I know some people who always have like, oh, I'm going to do this at the finish line. And to be honest, you know, that was something I did when I grew up. I remember doing specifically, I was running in the park by the university. I think I was 18 or 19, and I would picture myself winning these big races. And as I was running, I would do these celebrations, and I always thought, you know, I'm going to do that when I win. And then you get to the race, and you remember nothing of that. And a lot of my race finishes are just completely, I don't even remember, you know, I see the picture after and go, oh my goodness, I don't remember doing that. You know, in Tokyo, there's the video is I'm in the last 5 seconds, I'm just screaming. And I don't really remember doing that. There was no plan. Again, I'm a very, in terms of I've learned how to control them, but obviously emotions play a high factor in racing. If you can control them, they're a huge benefit, but if you can't, then obviously they can cause you a bit of trouble in racing if you get caught up into them.
When you're racing in Montreal, okay, so you say you're harnessing emotion, you're racing in Montreal, you've got the home crowd behind you. Did the home crowd help? Are you using them? Are you hearing them?
A lot of times in racing, I mean, completely in my own head.
Yeah. But
again, there's points in racing or moments in training that you use things around, you use tools that help you. And in that race, I specifically, when I would start to hurt, I would, look for some feedback. And that was the home crowd. And that was a tool that I used in that specific race that helped me. It doesn't mean that I'll use it in every race, but in that race, it definitely helped me. I had family at the race. What drove me extra was it being in Canada. I thought, like I told you, I may never get a chance to race something this big in Canada again. We're lucky to have these massive races in Canada at this point, but I got to take advantage of it.
Yeah, right. How about potential? You've talked about in the past about reaching the limits of, you say, human potential and your own potential. So what do you feel your own potential is?
I think I'm still discovering it, to be honest. I think physically and mentally, it's very hard to put, if you put a limit on yourself, then, you're going to have that limit. And I think one of the biggest things is me having open mind and not putting a limiter on what I'm capable of. For example, this year, I think was the first year that I started vomiting after a few of my big races because I had pushed so hard. And that's something that, I found a way to push harder, and that was a new limit I found this year. And had you asked me like a few years ago if I would be able to do that, I probably would have said, well, we'll see, because I never put a limit on what my capabilities or potential are, because as soon as you put a limiter on, you can only go that far.
Wow. Okay. And so did you reach that potential, that new level, just kind of as you were saying before, step by step, just, or was it something else that drives you, or is it just that process of whatever action you're in, whether it's swim, bike, or run?
Yeah. If you look at my results over the last like 5 or 10 years, there was never like, oh my goodness, that was crazy. It was very, step by step. And people who think that I had these massive breakthroughs, if you go back and look, it was like, well, no, he was, before he did that, before he had his first, result there, he was scratching on the surface there. And whatever the scenario was that I was able to have a breakthrough, I think it's easier to go back to a point that you've already been. So if I've pushed so hard or I've trained so hard or done this, it's easier for me to go back into the memory bank or the skill set or the systems I've set up. Again, like I talk about, it's easier to go back into that. What's hard is creating new levels. And that's what I'm still trying to do today is, create new levels, new systems, which allow me to go faster, harder, stronger.
Okay. And so do you, without giving, anything that might be a competitive disadvantage, but are you actively doing that for Tokyo 2021 then?
Yeah, I know. I finished that race and was like, that's great, but I got to be even fitter for next year. And it's crazy. I won the race and I still see flaws in my race a lot. Not a lot, but I would say that, I see flaws. I see every little thing that I would like to be better. And for me, I finished the race, won, and thought, man, I need to be even better next year, which was going to be this year. And obviously it's going to be next year, but I know I need to be even better. So it's never a steady state. There's never standing still. I'm always looking for something new, something better. It's never, that's going to be good enough. It's one of the worst. I've heard Jono say it a bunch. Good enough is like one of the worst things in high performance sport because it's just such a, settler's mentality.
Okay. Yeah. And who's you're setting kind of historic achievements, for Canada, and, having done things maybe no other Canadian male has done, who's a mentor you look up to, and what's some advice that you received that you've implemented and that's helped you?
I mean, I looked up to Simon Whitfield, growing up and getting into the sport. And yeah. I remember he sat down with me for a coffee in 2013. I was still a junior, and I remember being so starstruck. And I don't even, to be honest, I don't even remember what he said, but I remember him just taking the time and sitting down with me. And that was something that I really valued. And that I try to do now is that, you know, when I was that kid, how would I have wanted, you know, Simon to approach me? And I try to do something similar, not saying I'm Simon Whitfield, because I'm definitely not. We're different people. But he's someone I looked up to, and it wasn't necessarily the advice, but it was just how he carried himself and how he, you know, reflected himself with the younger generation. But in terms of mentors, I wouldn't say there's sport specific. There's obviously things I've learned from other athletes or people I look up to. I think that I try to take, and I'm always learning from whoever I'm with, and try to relate it to triathlon. That could be, you know, I'm with people who are high up in the financials and they're talking about something and go, huh, I could apply that to triathlon. And so there's just constantly like this, you know, relentless pursuit to learn more and learn from everyone and anyone, no matter what industry they're in.
Okay. That's interesting. So can you give an example of a financial aspect or something, some other industry that you've brought to triathlon?
So a good example would be like, I did 2 years of business school and university in accounting. And so I just use that as an example in terms of, I took accounting courses, and I remember doing one course and thinking is that in the same way that I kind of think now is they, you know, it's really an, it's not full of emotions. It's black and white. You analyze, you see what you know, you can change, what you can do better, what you can fix. And the less emotions you have in accounting or, you know, finance, the better, because, you know, it's black and white. I'm just crunching these numbers. And at certain points in triathlon, it's, you know, it's better to put the emotions aside and go, okay, well, I need to do this and this and this. And like I said, I'm quite an emotionally charged racer. And so learning to maybe sometimes put it on the side.
Wow, that's interesting. You know, I never would have thought an accounting lesson, but that's good stuff. So stay with me on the line. I'm just going to wrap up here. But there's a quote from you that I thought maybe encapsulates your mentality and your mindset. The tough years make you double check yourself. I wouldn't be here today without that tough year. It makes you realize how much you love the sport. These moments make it all worth it. Tyler, it's been a pleasure. We wish you all the best on your journey to Tokyo 2021. With training, we wish you a safe and healthy training with no more physical adversity. But I know if that happens, you'll be able to overcome based on your character and on your past history.
Thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it.
An amazing talk with the amazing Tyler Mislawchuk. Just smashing through barriers, running so hard that he gets sick at the end of the race now. And one of my favorite quotes from him is, I never put a limit on what my capabilities or potential are. Super tough, but genuinely a nice guy, and offline, very gracious, very kind, and down to earth. And I love the story about how when Jono, his coach, said, when you get your first win, that's when the floodgates will open. And that's what happened. He's climbed very rapidly in the world rankings, and he's a legitimate competitor and medal contender. Just a deep self-belief that he can do it, and setting big goals and not being afraid to go after them. Interestingly, you know, taking criticism from people who are not elite in the sport and about how he wanted to get a medal, but putting himself out there. I really appreciated how he did that, and balancing a winning mentality and learning to balance that with relaxation at the same time and evening things out. And again, how he achieves his self-belief kind of proves it through action speaking louder than words, setting big goals, and then just really going out there and proving them. And I had such a good talk with Tyler, and I'm a speaker and a coach. I'd love to explore the habits of the elite and exploring how people break through barriers to be their awesome selves. And I'd love to hear from you. So please like, subscribe, and share, and reach out to me. I'm at evolutionofleaders.com. Thank you so much for listening and watching.